On Sunday nights recently, we have been looking at King Saul's errors, things that he did wrong against God, and it's fertile ground to study. Sadly for him, God records much of the details of the life of King Saul and the things that he did that were not pleasing to God, and much from that that we can learn. Because temptations are common among men, and the things that Saul fell to were things that we can fall to also if we're not aware of how the devil is working, and if we're not knowledgeable of his devices and of the warnings of Scripture. So God does give us many things to learn from examples in Scripture of what not to do. And King Saul is certainly one of those. So it's worthwhile for us to take the time and look at the different things that God tells us about in Saul's life where he fell short of completing God's will and, in fact, transgressed against him many, many times. Tonight we want to, as last time we were in 1 Samuel chapter 13, a couple of times ago, we were looking at the sin that Saul committed when he made the sacrifice that he was not authorized to make in 1 Samuel 13. And we looked really at the basis of what was behind all of that last time, as King Saul was a man who was weak in his faith. And we particularly looked at the fact that he had not driven out the Jebusites from Jerusalem that God had commanded them to do. In contrast, David, as soon as he became king of Israel, drove out the Jebusites from Jerusalem and conquered that city, made it his own, where it had been originally included in the territory of the tribe of Benjamin, the tribe that King Saul was from himself. Yet he would not drive out those Jebusites. His faith was not strong in God and in the promises that God made. Now he had a son, was blessed with a very righteous son, who did trust the Lord with all of his heart, who did believe what God said, as we just had just sang together that song, Standing on the Promises. Well, Jonathan, Saul's son, did stand on God's promises. He believed in the word of God, and he obeyed his commandments. We're going to see the example that he set, the good example that Jonathan set in 1 Samuel chapter 14. And that was when he went and attacked a garrison of the Philistines and defeated them, only with his armor bearer with him, with his faith fully in God. And that led to a victory for Israel over the Philistines, which does go back to 1 Samuel 13, that background when the Philistines had gathered against Saul because Jonathan had defeated one of their garrisons to start with. And so they brought a great multitude against Saul and Israel. And the people were afraid, and they were, and his army was leaving him. He was left with 600 men. That's when he made that offering that he was not authorized to make. And then the prophet Samuel arrived, and God rebuked him through Samuel for having committed that great sin and said that his kingdom was not going to continue. But that situation with the Philistines gathered against Israel with only 600 men with Saul, that was still the situation when Jonathan went with his armor bearer and attacked one of their garrisons, and it led to a victory over that great multitude. And so God rewarded the faith of Jonathan, but King Saul did not have that faith. And at that same time, he ended up cursing his son Jonathan, who was righteous, when he had been weak in his own faith. And so 1 Samuel chapter 14 is going to be the basis of our study from God's Word tonight. But before we read from that, let's look at some background concerning the Philistines, because they play a prominent role in 1 Samuel 13 and 1 Samuel 14. And then when we get to chapter 17 with David and Goliath. And so there's much in the background of King Saul and a number of the very notable sins that he committed and areas where he fell short of God's glory because of a lack of faith in God that involved the Philistines. So if we're going to understand that, we have to go back. Where do we always go back to when we're in these studies from the Old Testament and we're looking at things that are going on to really have a full understanding of those situations? We always end up where? In Genesis, don't we? In that book of the beginnings, because that book records for us genealogies. It tells us much about where these different nations came from. And many times it will even give us the early histories of those nations or prophecies about them, things of that nature that we can learn from. And we read about the Philistines in the book of Genesis. Abraham and Isaac particularly had dealings with them, and those dealings were, by and large, not pleasant dealings. Abraham, of course, had been called out of his own land, of Ur of the Chaldees, to leave his people in that land that he had known when he was 75 years old. This is in Genesis 12. And he was called to go to the land of Canaan, to that land that God chose for him to sojourn in. And God made the promise that he was going to give that land to his seed, and repeated that promise to Isaac and to Jacob, the heirs of that promise. But did Abraham and Isaac and Jacob receive that promise themselves? Did they possess that land of Canaan for themselves, or were they strangers and pilgrims on this earth? And they were ultimately looking for that city, that heavenly city made by the living God. That's a big part of Hebrews 11 and the good examples of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and Sarah that we learn from. But they sojourned in the land of Canaan. And because of that, they also ended up having contact with the Philistines during their days. And we have record of some of those situations where they encountered the Philistines. They had some disputes involving their wives. Abraham's wife Sarah was taken by Abimelech, one of the Philistine rulers, in Genesis chapter 20. It is true that he was not aware at the time that he was taking another man's wife. But when it was revealed that that's what had happened, he did return her to Abraham. Yet, when you think about it, what kind of a man is going to just see somebody and take them like that? There's not good there, and we'll see the same thing later with Isaac and his wife Rebekah. But Genesis chapter 20, we'll read the end of this account when Abimelech took Sarah, and then he had to return her. And in verses 14 through 18, it says, Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah his wife. And Abimelech said, Behold, my land is before thee, dwell where it pleaseth thee. And unto Sarah he said, Behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all other. Thus she was reproved. So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children. For the Lord had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Now, we do see that there was a good ending for Abraham and Sarah from that situation, but it does give an example early on here of some of the unpleasant dealings that that Abraham had with those people, and that also came about with Isaac. Now, later, Isaac's wife, Rebekah, was also one that Abimelech cast his eyes upon in Genesis 26. If we can go there and read verses 8 through 11. And the last part of verse 7 mentions that Rebekah was fair to look upon. And so in verse 8 it says, It came to pass when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out at a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting with Rebekah his wife. And Abimelech called Isaac and said, Behold, of a surety she is thy wife, and how sayest thou, she is my sister? And Isaac said unto him, Because I said, lest I die for her. And Abimelech said, What is this thou hast done unto us? One of the people might lightly have lain with thy wife, and thou shouldest have brought guiltiness upon us. And Abimelech charged all his people, saying, "He that toucheth this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." I mean, you can look at the words of Abimelech himself in verse 10. That's a testimony about the morals of those people, the Philistines, and what their manner of dealing with women was like. And obviously, fornication was rampant. They were immoral, wicked people. Well, in verse 12, then it starts to describe how God blessed Isaac. We'll go back to that, Lord willing, in a minute. There were water disputes, not just wife disputes, but water disputes. That is a land where there's many dry areas, and that still is the case today. And there's still land disputes, as we well know, in that part of the world. There always has been. But even going back to the book of Genesis, we see there being conflict in the land, and there were disputes over water supplies. Let's read in Genesis chapter 21 what happened again with Abraham as he dealt with the Philistines. Genesis 21, verses 25 through 34. "And Abraham reproved Abimelech because of a well of water which Abimelech's servants had violently taken away. And Abimelech said, 'I wot not who hath done this thing, neither didst thou tell me, neither yet heard I of it, but today.' And Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them unto Abimelech, and both of them made a covenant, and Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech said unto Abraham, 'What mean these seven ewe lambs which thou hast set by themselves?' And he said, 'For these seven ewe lambs shalt thou take of my hand, that they may be a witness unto me that I have digged this well.' Wherefore he called that place Beersheba, because there they swear both of them. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, and they returned into the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a grove in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days." Just from what we're reading of what Abraham, and that's just a little bit of information, he was there many days, but is the overall impression we get that he was dealing with righteous people, those Philistines? Not at all. Now later, Isaac, as we said, he had the same situation with them coveting his wife. Well, there was also the same kinds of disputes and dealings where they were wronging them over the wells of water. Let's look at back in chapter 26. We read through verse 11 a little bit ago, but let's pick it up now, verse 12 of Genesis 26. And this is about Isaac. It says, "Then Isaac sowed in that land, and received in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him, and the man waxed great, and went forward and grew until he became very great, for he had possession of flocks and possession of herds and great store of servants, and the Philistines envied him." Who can stand before envy? Well, there's the root problem that was there, and then how long did that persist? I mean, this started with Abraham. It came, it persisted through Isaac and on to Jacob. Well, of course, then they sojourned in Egypt for those 400 years. But as soon as they came into the land of Canaan, how long did it take before the Philistines became a problem and a recurrent problem? And we see much down the line, the roots that we're reading of here in Genesis, we can see the same issues many years later with their descendants, with the children of Israel in the time of King Saul and Jonathan and David. But after it says there that the Philistines envied him in verse 14, it says in verse 15, "For all the wells which his father's servants had digged in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines had stopped them and filled them with earth." So what about that covenant that they had made when his Abimelech's servant had violently taken away one of Abraham's wells and then made that covenant between the two of them? Well, did he honor that covenant? Or did the Philistines fill up with dirt all of Abraham's wells that were in their area? That was not honoring that covenant at all. And so verse 16, "Abimelech said to Isaac, 'Go from us, for thou art much mightier than we.' And Isaac departed thence and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac digged again the wells of water which they had digged in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them after the death of Abraham. And he called their names after the names by which his father had called them. And Isaac's servants digged in the valley and found there a well of springing water. And the herdmen of Gerar did strive with Isaac's herdmen, saying, "The water is ours." And he called the name of the well Esek, because they strove with him. And they digged another well and strove for that also. And he called the name of it Sitna. And he removed from thence and digged another well, and for that they strove not. And he called the name of it Rehoboth. And he said, "For now the Lord hath made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." And he went up from thence to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared unto him the same night and said, "I am the God of Abraham thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee and will bless thee and multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake." And he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants digged a well. Then Abimelech went to him from Gerar, and Ahuzzah one of his friends, and Phicol the chief captain of his army. And Isaac said unto them, "Wherefore come ye to me, seeing ye hate me and have sent me away from you?" And they said, "We saw certainly that the Lord was with thee. And we said, let there be now an oath betwixt us, even betwixt us and thee, and let us make a covenant with thee, that thou wilt do us no hurt, as we have not touched thee, and as we have done unto thee nothing but good, and have sent thee away in peace. Thou art now the blessed of the Lord." And he made them a feast, and they did eat and drink, and they rose up betimes in the morning and swear one to another, and Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. Now all that we're reading here is just telling us what happened between Abraham and Isaac and the Philistines, those situations involving their wives, the situations that involved the land and the water and the wells, all of that. But there was conflict there, and the Philistines were not righteous people, and that is very evident from these situations that we read about in the book of Genesis. And so God did appoint them for destruction, as he did with the other inhabitants of the land of Canaan. Now, God had determined to spare the children of Ammon and the children of Moab and the children of Edom. Ammon and Moab were descendants. Those were the two nations that descended from Lot, Abraham's nephew. The land of Edom, they were the descendants of Esau, Jacob's twin brother. And so God had given them a designated inheritance of land that bordered upon Israel. But the land of Canaan he was giving to the children of Israel, which was the best of the land. Those nations that inhabited that that land, God appointed for utter destruction for their wickedness. And God also intended for the Philistines to be destroyed. Let's turn to the book of Joshua to chapter 13. Did the Lord appreciate those people and how they dealt with God's faithful and righteous servants back in the time there, the book of Genesis that we were just reading about? Of course, God didn't appreciate that at all. And as we're reading about their wickedness then, did they just stay at a sort of a baseline level of wickedness? Or do we see the tendency that wickedness increases? And like God said about the Amorites that dwelt in the land of Canaan, he was going to give them that land of Canaan after 400 years of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob sojourning in Egypt until the wickedness of the Amorites became full. Their wickedness was going to increase until it became complete. Well, the Philistines very evidently followed that same path, and they had the same appointment for destruction. Let's read Joshua 13, 1-3. It says, "Now Joshua was old and stricken in years, and the Lord said unto him, Thou art old and stricken in years, and there remaineth yet very much land to be possessed. This is the land that yet remaineth. All the borders of the Philistines and all Geshurai from Sihor, which is before Egypt, even unto the borders of Ekron northward, which is counted to the Canaanite, five lords of the Philistines, the Gazathites and the Ashkathites, the Eshkalonites, and Gittites and the Ekronites and also the Avites." And those were the inhabitants of those five cities of the Philistines that they had their lords over. But God intended for that to be part of the possession of Israel. And he said so there. And that still remained to be conquered when Joshua became very advanced in age. In the book of Judges in chapter 1, the Lord gives an account in this chapter of examples of the disobedience of the children of Israel who did not drive out the inhabitants of their territories. Last week we looked at part of this same chapter when it was describing how the children of Benjamin did not drive the Jebusites out of Jerusalem. That's included in here. But what about the children of Judah? They were the ones given that territory that included the land that the Philistines possessed, or at least a major portion of that, and they did not drive them out from there. Let's read from Judges chapter 1, in verse 19. It says, "And the Lord was with Judah, and he drove out the inhabitants of the mountain, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley, because they had chariots of iron." The hilly area of Judah is that portion of their land, well, where Jerusalem was, but all those areas over there. And but there was the valley, of course, by the sea that included the Philistines' land. And the Philistines, they were a warrior people. And it says they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because of their chariots. Well, does that mean that there was some reason that God was unable to give them enough strength to overcome those chariots? Was it a failure on God's part? Of course not. But where was the failure? In the faith of the children of Judah. They obviously saw those chariots, and their faith wasn't strong enough for them to go and conquer them. What would have happened if they had? Well, what happened when 85-year-old Caleb went and attacked Hebron and all the giants that dwelt there? Did that appear to be much of a problem? And you can read chapters 14 and 15 of this of the book of Joshua and see how the Lord delivered Hebron to Caleb, again rewarding his faith. Remember last week when we read those passages from the book of Deuteronomy where God promised that he would deliver their enemies into their hand if they kept their commandments? When did that promise ever fail from God? When the children of Israel had their faith in God and obeyed him, when did the promises ever fail? That's again why we stand upon the promises. God does not fail to keep his word if we do what he tells us to do. And we should never doubt him. Yet we see many examples in the scriptures where the Israelites did have such doubts. And of course, Saul himself is a very notable one of that. Well, in Judges 3, after rebuking the children of Israel for not driving out all the inhabitants of their territories that they had conquered, God, in chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, mentions the thorns that would be left in their sides, and the Philistines are particularly singled out here as ones that would plague the Israelites because of their failure to destroy them. Judges 3, 1 to 7. "Now these are the nations which the Lord left to prove Israel by them, even as many of Israel as had not known all the wars of Canaan, only that the generations of the children of Israel might know to teach them war, at the least such as before knew nothing thereof. Namely, five lords of the Philistines, and all the Canaanites and the Sidonians and the Hivites that dwelt in Mount Lebanon from Mount Baal Hermon unto the entering in of Hamath. And they were to prove Israel by them to know whether they would hearken unto the commandments of the Lord, which he commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. And the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters to be their wives and gave their daughters to their sons and served their gods. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served Balaam in the groves." Now, did they also do the same with the Philistines? Well, they're part of those Amorite people that dwelt there. And they did, as he says, they would be a thorn in their side. And that proved to be the case. And they did end up marrying their sons and daughters to those people and then went after their idols. Let's turn to chapter 10, Judges chapter 10, and look at verses 6 and 7. Judges 10, 6 and 7. "And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam and Ashtaroth and the gods of Syria and the gods of Sidon and the gods of Moab and the gods of the children of Ammon and the gods of the Philistines and forsook the Lord and served not him. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the children of Ammon." So at this particular time in their history, when they had their judges, this was after Gideon's death, and they went through that time when Gideon's son rebelled and tried to make himself king. Well, then after that, the children of Israel departed from the Lord, and it mentions specifically the Philistines were one of the ones that the children of Israel went and served their idols. And God punished them. And it's interesting how often God would use the very nations when the Israelites would serve the idols of these nations, that he would then raise up those nations to oppress them and to rule over them. And so he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites at this time. And then we read a little bit more here in chapter 13, flipping over there to chapter 13 of Judges in verse 1. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. Then he began to deliver them right at, this is as it's introducing us to Samson, whose birth is recorded later in this chapter. And then God raised him up to begin to deliver the children of Israel from the hand of the Philistines, which was the purpose that God set for him, according to verse 5 here in Judges chapter 13. So the Philistines, we can see, were a problem for Abraham and Isaac. They became a problem for the Israelites at various times during the Judges because they did not drive them out of the land when God had appointed them for destruction. And so they continued to be a problem right down to the time that we're studying when Saul is king of Israel. And even before that, when Samuel was a judge of Israel, what was going on when God punished Israel for their rebellion against him, when Eli was the high priest of Israel under his wicked sons Hophni and Phinehas, who were other priests of Israel? Well, he sold them into the hands of the Philistines, and they defeated Israel. And what did they do with the Ark of the Covenant in 1 Samuel chapter 4? We don't have time to read all that right now. But they took the Ark of the Covenant. Chapter 5 of 1 Samuel describes what happened when they took that to the Ark of the Covenant to their own land. They first put it in the house of Dagon and Ashtaroth, or Ashdod, and then it plagued the Philistines. God plagued them there for that. And eventually, after many months and being plagued from city to city, they sent the Ark of the Covenant back to Israel, pulled by two cows. And so then in chapter 7, 4 through 7, finally in chapter 7, when Samuel was the prophet and judge of Israel, the Israelites defeated the Philistines. Well, they came back, though, now that Saul is king, and they're causing trouble again for Israel. And what was one of the main jobs that God had Saul designated to do when he gave in to the desires of the Israelites and let them have their desire for a king? 1 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 16, God tells one of the reasons or one of the jobs that he was going to give to their new king, Saul. 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 16, "Tomorrow about this time I will send thee a man out of the land of Benjamin." This is God speaking to the prophet Samuel. He says, "And thou shalt anoint him to be captain over my people, Israel, that he may save my people out of the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people because their cry is come upon me, is coming to me." So he had chosen King Saul. One of his purposes was to fight against and to defeat the Philistines. Now, he did fight many battles with them. But how often do we see Saul's faith in God weak and not carrying through to do the job that God gave him to fight against and to destroy those people? And in his time, when Saul wouldn't have the faith to do it, he'd appointed the Philistines for destruction. So when he couldn't use Saul because Saul's faith was weak, then who did he use? Well, he used Jonathan. He used David. And so he would use principally those two men whose faith was strong in God and they obeyed him. And so he accomplished the purpose of defeating the Philistines. But when the one that was chosen to be king that should have been doing it, didn't. And that was Saul's failure. Well, again, that was the background of what was behind that situation in 1 Samuel 13 when Saul offered that sacrifice that he was not authorized to make, recorded there in verses 6 through 14. But he was afraid at that time. The people were leaving him. And what do we learn from that? Are we supposed to be afraid? Are we supposed to be afraid of men? Are we supposed to be afraid of anything in this life. I mean, we're supposed to fear God, but what about man? That's not what God wants us to do. In Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 through 6, this is a reminder of one of the lessons from we read about those fearful ones who were weak in faith like Saul. We need to remember from that what not to do. Here's what we should do. Hebrews 13, 5 and 6 says, "Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have, for he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." So there's another one of those great and precious promises from God that we have. He will never leave us nor forsake us. Now, if we serve the Lord, if we don't forsake him, he's never going to forsake us. Do we have to be afraid that God is going to leave us in our lives if we're serving him? We shouldn't fear that. We should have no doubt in God whatsoever. There's no acceptable reason for us to doubt God in keeping his promise. He says he will never leave us nor forsake us. So no matter what happens in our lives, no matter how bad it is or how bleak things look at any moment in time, God is there with us. He will work it together for our good. He promises that also in Romans 8 and verse 28. He's not going to leave us. He's not going to forsake us. And if God be for us, who can be against us? Well, verse 6, he says, "So that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me." We should be able to boldly say that. Now, we shouldn't say that if it's not true, but it should be true that that is our faith, that our trust is in the Lord, and that we're not afraid of what man will do to us. But so many are, like Saul, and that's sad to see. The Lord Jesus Christ gives us an example in the parable of the talents in Matthew chapter 25, verses 24 and 25. In that parable, we have two good examples, the five-talent man and the two-talent man. And then we also have the bad example of the one-talent man in this particular parable. And that man in verses 24 and 25 here in Matthew chapter 25 says, "Then he which had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown and gathering where thou hast not strewed. And I was afraid and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine." So he was afraid and he didn't do what God wanted him to do. He didn't serve the Lord as God had commanded him to. So he didn't serve his Lord. And then he was punished as the end of the parable comes and tells us about. Revelation chapter 21 and verse 8. It tells us who's going to have their part in the lake of fire. Revelation 21 and verse 8. We might not like to hear about or read about the lake of fire, but God tells us about that for a reason, and we should very much like to know who's going to be there to make sure that whatever he describes as the ones who will be there, that we're not that. Well, that's why we're looking at it now. Revelation 21, 8. Notice the first thing he mentions. Is that surprising at all? He says, "But the fearful." You know, he doesn't. There might be several things that we might expect to be listed number one when he's talking about who's going to have their part in the lake of fire. Would any of us think that the first thing God's going to mention is fearful? Well, that's what he does. He says, "But the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." Now, what does God think of the fearful? And we've seen so many scriptures in the last few minutes about that. And there's no place for us to have fear and doubt in our God. We have to serve him with our faith in him. And so we have ones like Jonathan and David who did not have fear. Their fear was only in the Lord, which is the right kind of fear. But they were not ones that were like King Saul. So Saul had a son and a son-in-law who both had their faith in God, but he did not. Now we're going to get to see Jonathan's faith very much on display in 1 Samuel chapter 14. Now, he was one that believed what God said in Deuteronomy 7. I know we looked at part of this passage last week, but we can refresh on it just to once again hear what God said, to note how Jonathan heard these words and believed them. which is the source of faith. Deuteronomy 7, verses 16 through 26. The Lord said there, "Thou shalt consume all the people which the Lord thy God shall deliver thee." And that includes the Philistines, doesn't it? He says, "Thine eyes shall have no pity upon them, neither shalt thou serve their gods, for that will be a snare unto thee. If thou shalt say in thine heart, these nations are more than I, how can I dispossess them?" Or like we saw in Judges, what if they have chariots? Verse 18 says, "Thou shalt not be afraid of them, but shalt well remember what the Lord thy God did unto Pharaoh and unto all Egypt." Do they have chariots? Do they have a big army? We remember what happened there. Verse 19, "The great temptations which thine eyes saw, and the signs and the wonders, and the mighty hand and the stretched out arm, whereby the Lord thy God brought thee out. So shall the Lord thy God do unto all the people of whom thou art afraid. Moreover, the Lord thy God shall send a hornet among them until they that are left hide themselves from thee, he be destroyed. Thou shalt not be affrighted at them, for the Lord thy God is among you, a mighty God and terrible. And the Lord thy God will put out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beast of the field increase upon thee. But the Lord thy God shall deliver them unto thee, and shall destroy them with a mighty destruction until they be destroyed. And he shall deliver their kings into thine hand, and thou shalt destroy their name from under heaven. There shall no man be able to stand before thee until thou have destroyed them. The graven images of their gods shall you burn with fire. Thou shalt not desire the silver or gold that is on them, nor take it unto thee, lest thou be snared therein, for it is an abomination to the Lord thy God. Neither shalt thou bring an abomination into thine house, lest thou be a cursed thing like it. But thou shalt utterly detest it, and thou shalt utterly abhor it, for it is a cursed thing." Well, that's what God said about all those nations, and the Philistines are included in that. As we read earlier, God had appointed them for destruction, as he was speaking about there, and he commanded them, don't be afraid of those people. Go out and fight them. The Lord would be with them, and he would deliver them into their hands. Well, Jonathan believed that. And so in 1 Samuel chapter 13, the very first thing we ever read about Jonathan in the Bible in 1 Samuel 13 is his faith on display. In verse 3, it says, "And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it, and Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear." So that's what precipitated the Philistines coming in mass against Israel. Well, was God punishing Israel because of Jonathan's faith, that when he slew a garrison of them, then God brings the whole army after him? That wasn't punishment. That was an opportunity. So instead of destroying a garrison, okay, Jonathan had faith to do that. Now how about the whole army? Well, and that's what's going to end up happening in chapter 14. It takes overcoming and getting around Saul's weakness, but Jonathan's going to go after him again, and ultimately they're going to have a great victory. That's recorded in 1 Samuel 14, but it's because of the faith of Jonathan. So we'll pick it up from there, Lord willing, next Sunday night, we want to look at 14, and we'll try to look at chapter 17 together for the next part, with Jonathan and David, their faith in contrast to Saul's, and then we see the way Saul responded against the righteous, against his own son Jonathan, and against David, his servant. And so that's something else for us to look at about Saul. So Lord willing, we'll continue with our study of Saul and his errors and sins next Sunday night.